Howdy, listener, and thanks for tuning into our podcast, The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. My name is Izzy.
And my name is David. Each week, one of us will pick a movie that the other has not seen. We will deep dive into our individual takes and historical background of the movie.
Please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Instagram at TML A Journey Through Cinema and Twitter at TML A Journey.
Welcome to the Movie Log. Today we're traveling back to 1963 for the film Cleopatra, written and directed by Joseph L. Mankiewicz. The screenplay is adapted by Mankiewicz, Ronald McDougall, and Sidney Buckman from the 1957 book The Life and Times of Cleopatra by Carlo Maria Fanzaro, along with other historical writings. The movie stars Elizabeth Taylor as Cleopatra, Richard Burton as Mark Antony, Rex Harrison as the Big J.C., Julius Caesar, Rodney McDowell as Octavian, who later becomes Caesar Augustus, and Martin Landau as Rufio.
Rufio.
All right. So, for people who are not familiar with the story, Bella's going to give a very brief rundown.
The movie follows Cleopatra's rise and fall as Queen of Egypt. The movie starts with the arrival of Julius Caesar as executor for the current pharaoh, Ptolemy XIII, Cleopatra's brother, but later executes him and his followers after Cleopatra convinces him to restore her claim to the throne. She is crowned Queen of Egypt and starts in her first of two love affairs we see in this movie, the only one of which produces a son. After Caesar is made dictator for life, Cleopatra arrives in Rome and wins the hearts of all the Roman people. Caesar is killed and Cleopatra flees after Octavian is named Caesar's heir, not her and Julius Caesar's son. While planning a campaign, Mark Antony realizes he is short of money and supplies. The only place to turn to is Egypt. Cleopatra, who met Mark Antony during her arrival in Rome, agrees to meet him and gives him supplies. They start the second love affair of the movie and get into an argument when Mark Antony returns to Rome and marries Octavia, Octavian's sister, to prevent conflict with the Roman Senate and Octavian. To make a long story short,
too late.
Cleopatra and Mark Antony's affair, Antony gifting Egypt Roman lands, Antony recognizing that Cleopatra's son is the true heir of Rome, and many more delicacies, caused the Roman Senate to rage war against Egypt. The two lovers lose the war to Octavian, and believing Cleopatra is dead, Mark Antony stabs himself with his sword, dies in Cleopatra's arm, and is taken to be buried in Alexandria. Cleopatra has a talk with Octavian about her coming to Rome as a trophy, and later her and her servants kills themselves with the help of her trusty snake.
All right, so why did you pick this movie? You were talking to me about it, and when we were putting together this season, you said, hey, I want to put this movie in. Have you ever seen it? And I said, no, I heard it was bad. And you said, well, you watched it in school, liked it, and then you were surprised that it had this like negative history. We wanted to watch it and reassess it ourselves.
Well, you are right. I actually watched one of the 2013 50th anniversary restored editions for my theater class at the time, and we watched it over 3 days, and I was, like you said, I was confused by the bad reception it got back in the day. Also for the fact that when someone says Liz Taylor or Elizabeth Taylor, the first thing that comes to mind, even before watching the movie, has always been that iconic picture of her and head to toe in gold Egyptian headdress with the wings of Isis and her golden dress. That's like the picture that comes to mind when someone says Elizabeth Taylor. And I think for a lot of people, that's also what comes to mind. So I was really confused on why such a movie that is so iconic would have such a bad reputation in the past.
We watched it again. And one of the things that I think that we both said was we sat down and watched it in one go. And it's 4 hours and 10 minutes. And it feels like 4 hours and 10 minutes. When that intermission comes, you should get up and do something because it's almost the 2 hour mark exactly. We found out while we were doing research for the film why the movie was so long. But do you feel that the movie was long enough, too long? Was it, did it keep your interest for those whole 4 hours?
I think it's 20 minutes too long. And as for a movie that's already 4 hours long, you might be like, what does 20 minutes mean? There are some parts of the movie that I believe could have been cut out. And of course, it's hard to say, well, everything should be cut out because it's a 4 hour movie. But I think there were some scenes towards the end that could have been cut. And one of the things that really bothered me about watching it all in one sitting is that it's a dialogue heavy movie. And I love dialogue heavy movies, but they're usually within 90 minute movie mark. And so there's a lot of talk about war and what happened in war and things like that. But because the studio couldn't create all these battles and stuff, there's a lot of talk about war and no action. And that's the thing I think a lot of people don't really like, especially nowadays. We're so used to action, is that it's mostly just people in a room talking about what happened. And there's no like cutbacks and forth, you know, it's pretty still.
Yes. I think one of the things that you point out there is that the studio couldn't afford to put the money into these big battle scenes. But it was really odd for me because they had all these extras. They had these big, huge scenes. They would have these sweeping shots and they would show you all of Alexandria or Rome. And so there was a lot of money put into the film, but you're sitting there going, why can they afford to have at least one battle scene? And the final battle scene, the final battle, when you finally get to the battle, is so because it's on boats on these models, obviously in a tank being pushed around. But most of the time you're just watching them talking about, there's these faraway shots for this Navy out there and they're talking about it. So you're right. There's none of this balance of talking and action. It's a really good example to show people for writing screenplays. There's a rule, show, don't tell. And this movie does a lot of telling and not showing. And I think the beginning with Caesar actually seemed a little bit more well-formed than the ending with Mark Antony.
I would 100% agree with that, in the sense that I think before the intermission is definitely the strongest parts of this movie.
I think that the thing, too, that makes it interesting for me was Richard Burton's portrayal of Mark Antony. I've seen other versions of the Mark Antony story. They usually play Mark Antony more as a jock who, he's a good warrior, but he's a very straightforward warrior. So all the politics and stuff, he can't read it. So he gets beaten that way. This one is like, no, he's good enough, but he's a drunk and has a crippling self-doubt. And so, which is why he latches on to Cleopatra in this version. It's like he's latched on to Cleopatra because of she's the one that makes him feel like he's Mark Antony. I found that portrayal interesting, but it wasn't tight. It didn't seem fully formed.
One of the things that I also remember from watching it the first time is that I knew that I didn't know at the time all the background history and all that. About their relationship, but I knew that at least at one time they were married. Elizabeth
Taylor?
Taylor, oh my God. I kept on trying to say Elizabeth Banks, and I was like, that's wrong. Elizabeth, I know at one time Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton were married, and so when I first watched it, I kind of had this thought of, like, in my mind, she had more chemistry with Julius Caesar than she did with Mark Antony. And I always found that weird.
It's not weird. Your observation of them not having chemistry together is not uncommon. They did Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and they have good chemistry in that film.
It's also about a couple arguing.
No, I know, but it's like, I mean, I'm not saying they have a romantic chemistry, but they have the good acting chemistry together. It's almost like in this movie, they were like shooting two different movies.
Well, you mentioned that. And for those who don't know, this movie was actually supposed to be two different movies. It was supposed to be Cleopatra and Julius Caesar, then Mark Antony and Cleopatra. kind of separate the story based on her two loves of her life. And because of all the drama that was happening behind this, all the drama that was happening behind camera, because the public was so fascinated by the affair, the execs at the studio were so afraid that nobody was going to show up for Julius Caesar and Cleopatra. So they were like, we got to form the play movies together.
You told me that, and I said that makes sense because it did feel like they went back and they reshot stuff to make sure that it was all flowed together, which it doesn't. And there's also characters that seem like they were meant to be bigger characters, and they weren't, like Octavia and a couple other characters like this come, go really quick. You feel like there was a bigger part there. They kind of like sped into the meeting of Antony and Cleopatra after Caesar dies. Like, there's a whole bunch of stuff that happens that you could tell that they were going to talk about, which I think is why we were, one of the things that we're complaining about is there's these scenes that are all them talking. It's like, I would bet some of those scenes were because, well, we have to explain why we're taking an immediate left instead of going forward. Like the screenplay has been dictating, which the movie's been dictating. So we're going to sit around the room and we're going to have everybody talk, and so the audience knows why we're going over to Egypt now. You feel like how much money they sank into that film, not having one or two battle scenes, which, quite frankly, people would have forgot about some of the holes if there was exciting, you know, like Ben-Hur has some exciting scenes. Kind of, you kind of forget about some of the plot holes because of the exciting scenes. And I also feel like the people who made that decision to combine them, kind of made that decision, and then they got mad at the actors and the director, and they said, you're the reason why everything didn't work, when it's like they're the ones that actually changed the plan.
Can I just give you a bullet point presentation about how many things happened behind the camera that led to this movie being made?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay.
Because you're probably going to, what you're going to say is going to enlighten me, because I have had zero interest in this film. So even in books that I've read about the type of film this is, the Roman epic or the sword and sandal movies, when they come to this movie, I usually skip it. So
okay, well, this movie is a certified hot mess. So when I say that there's problems on set, I really mean that there was problems on set. So first of all, this is the most expensive film ever made up until this point in time, and almost bankrupt 20th Century Fox.
There are people who still argue that it is still the most expensive film ever made, because if you take
yeah, inflation. I wrote it down somewhere. $44 million to be made in 1963, but that would make it $370 million in 2020 money.
Yeah, so even like the Avenger films that haven't crossed that line yet.
So you can make that argument. I'm going to start off with death behind camera. So a World War II bomb gets set off and kills some carpenters and builders while they're building sets because there was a mine left over from World War II. So that's the first thing that happens.
Where was this, in Italy or in Egypt? Oh, you don't know?
I don't know. I don't know where it is, but...
Because both of those places were battlegrounds, so I was just curious.
Yeah, they did build a lot of things in Italy, so I'm assuming it's Italy because I didn't read anywhere that they built anything in Egypt. Then, number two, they had what people like to call the Strike of the Slave Girls, which is the strike of all the female extras because they kept on getting hit on, and there was a lot of sexually aggressive behavior from the Italian male extras and the Italian male crew. They went on strike for better work environment. That lasted for about 2 weeks, okay. I think, or at least that's how it sounds with the article that I read. The whole Burton and Taylor affair we mentioned before. Then the Egyptian government almost didn't let Elizabeth Taylor into the country because she was Jewish, because she converted for her first husband. But they changed their mind after a lot of pleading from the studio, and also they realized American money in the economy might be really good. So that held up filming. It was supposed to be two different movies, which we talked about. It was supposed to be Julius Caesar and Cleopatra and Antony and Cleopatra. But the public's fascination with the affair made it into one movie. That held up filming because they needed to do reshoots, and there was 47 pages of reshoots, which were getting written at the same time that they were filming.
Wasn't like a 6-month gap there too, or something like that?
Yeah, there was a 6-month gap when filming, and you can
when filming principal photography quit, and then they decided, oh, we're going to combine these two films. So then they 6 months later started filming again.
Yes, and you can totally tell if you watch Cleopatra's son, because he goes from a dark-haired small child to a blonde-haired Italian child with a thick Italian accent. So you can totally tell between what scenes were filmed before and after. Also, you can kind of tell with the big Cleopatra coming into Rome scene with like the parade and stuff, because the parade was shot 6 months before Cleopatra's Sphinx entrance was shot. So the lighting and stuff is a little weird. They lost 2 hours of the original movie. They have no idea where it is, and they keep saying that if they ever find it, they'll put it into the movie and send out a 6-hour Cleopatra for anybody who wants to watch. They fired the director during the reshoots, but he was also the only one writing the movie at the time. And so that was, so nobody knew how the movie was going to be put together, because he was the only person who knew what was happening with the movie. So they rehired him. He always jokes that this was the toughest 3 movies he ever had to make. It was the highest grossing movie of that year. Still didn't make the money. It didn't make a profit until 1973. So almost 10 years after this movie was made, it still didn't make its money. And that was because, I forget who bought it, but somebody bought it for $5 million, which at the time was the most someone ever bought for a movie. That sent them over the edge. And then 20th Century Fox lied and kept secret that they made a profit. So all the money that was coming to them for the movie was they were putting in their pockets, so they didn't have to pay anybody who was making a percentage off the movie.
Did that ever get fixed?
I don't know. But I thought that was a fun story a little bit.
That's one of these things that one of these days I'd love to talk about James Garner and Cliff Robertson were two actors who ended up suing the studios in the late 60s, early 70s. And because of that. And they're the ones that put Cliff Robertson did it first, and then James Garner did it second. And that's one reason why James Garner went from making movies to making television. Two reasons. One, people didn't want to make movies with him anymore. Second reason was because he found he had more control and he could see the receipts in television. So, and if you ever read his book, he explains it.
Also, due to a clerical error, they might have cost Roddy McDowall a Best Supporting Actor nomination because they wanted to give him up for a consideration for his work as Octavian, but they put him as a lead actor role. But because they did that, and he wasn't a lead actor role, they wrote a letter saying, oh my God, we're so sorry. But because they wrote the letter, he might have gotten an Oscar for his work, but because they didn't know what they were doing, he didn't get an Oscar. There was a lot more, but those are like kind of the ones that I was fascinated by.
The little bit that I do know was how much money the studio sank into this movie. And that's when you think about it. This is 1963. They spent $44 million on that movie, and there is no battle scene
until the very end.
I wouldn't call that a battle scene. That was a model scene that was disguised as a battle scene.
There was a quote that I read while researching this movie, and I thought it was funny. Because of how much models that they had, they kept joking that 20th Century Fox had the biggest navy on the planet.
Thing that I thought was very interesting is you have Julius Caesar, who's famous for the battles that he won and fought. You have Mark Antony, who's famous for the battles he won and fought. And you have the Egyptian civil war that's going on. And then Cleopatra uses Julius Caesar and Mark Antony to secure her throne during the civil war. And you're sitting there going, not one battle, not one war. There's actually this one huge scene where they're going over the after effects of a battle. And you're like going, it probably would have been cheaper to actually film the battle than actually make the whole earth look scorched and all these dead bodies everywhere. And again, and they told you, we just fought a battle. No, you just showed us you fought a battle. We got that part. I was surprised how much I enjoyed Rex Harrison as Julius Caesar. Because honestly, I don't ever think of him as Julius Caesar. Because I always think of him as like from My Fair Lady and Dr. Doolittle and those type of movies. I was like, Julius Caesar, he's probably going to be really campy. But no, he was really good. And I liked him. I liked Elizabeth Taylor as Cleopatra. I liked Martin Landau as Rufio. And I liked Hume Cronin as the advisor for Cleopatra. I was bored stiff with Richard Burton. I've seen Richard Burton in other movies, and I liked him in them. I've even seen him in other movies he didn't like, and you could tell that he was just kind of phoning it in that I liked him better in. So I don't know what was – I don't think he was a good Mark Antony.
No, I totally understand. I definitely have seen better Mark Antonys in, you know, anything from History Channel show to somebody's Mark Antony from Julius Caesar from William Shakespeare. I've seen – multiple Mark Antonys, and I think he's, in my opinion, has one of the weaker performances. Though he did, like you said, have some great character choices, it's really hard to think of somebody as a warrior and as a person who can command things, command people, and shout to the world, this is who I am, I'm going to kick you in your butt. When you're mumbling through your lines, which I understand that they portrayed him as a drunkard, but to be completely honest with you, halfway through Mark Antony's time on screen, I didn't even realize that he was a drunkard.
Really?
Yeah.
They're making lines about it all the time, and you smell like wine, or they were like,
oh, the first line that somebody introduced him as, that one should have tipped me off.
Yeah.
But it might just be because it was hot yesterday.
It's one of those things where you know how the movie's going to end because you know how in history Cleopatra, what happens to Cleopatra and Mark Antony. So it's like you're kind of sitting there going, how do you make it interesting? And so I did think it was an interesting choices that he made about, or the director and him made, that he was going to be more somebody who's crippled by self-doubt and drinking than somebody who didn't have the guile to realize the conspiracies and the people going up against him. You can still make interesting choices as an actor and be very flat.
Yes, you can.
The director, before he made this film, he made in 1953, 10 years before, Julius Caesar, which is based on Shakespeare's play Julius Caesar.
With Marlon Brando as Mark Antony.
Yeah, and Marlon Brando is another person that you wouldn't think of as a straightforward Mark Antony. He gives a really good performance in that film. I have seen that film. The director had written an adaptation and made a film already of Julius Caesar. So I think that's one of the reasons also why the Julius Caesar part is stronger, because it's like he was in his wheelhouse already. And the Cleopatra part at the first half was very good. And then, of course, it started to really fall apart in the end. I find it very interesting that he's already made a film with Mark Anthony. He's already done this approach, this subject matter. And this one, the Mark Anthony is just so flat.
I've always viewed Mark Anthony as like a romantic hero, mm-hmm. almost. Yeah. And you can have flaws as a romantic hero. Heck, a lot of romantic heroes are drunkards and deal with some things like that. But this one I didn't feel like was a romantic hero. And towards the end of the movie, my brain was like, girl, you were better off with Julius Caesar.
Yeah, and Julius Caesar, of course, if he hadn't have forced the make me emperor, then he would have lived. And he could, and that's the thing too. I think her life was so tied to Julius Caesar's life that the minute he went down at that point, she's just trying to work and trying to stay alive and guarantee that her son's going to stay alive. And Mark Anthony was not the right person to join up with. And I think thing too is that they don't really talk about that final battle, how it really affected the rest of Rome and Egypt, and how if they even won that battle, it may not have mattered because Rome was sending a second army to Egypt around them.
Well, so this is a movie, as you said before, as we touched, you know, with our little history dust, that this is a historical drama. You might actually say that it's a costume drama because the costumes are like the main character in this
movie. The costumes and the set pieces are amazing. Yes. And you see the money that they spent. I just don't see all the money that they spent.
Yeah. Well, they made 79 sets and 200... Nope, just kidding. They made 79 sets and 26,000 costumes. And most of the costume budget went to Elizabeth Taylor's costumes.
Okay, wow. So they made 26,000 costumes and most of the money still went to her.
But yeah, so most of the money went into Elizabeth Taylor's costumes. And actually, while you're watching the credits at the beginning, there's a specific credit that always gets my eye, which is Elizabeth Taylor's costume designer. So I always think it's really interesting that they had like a specific costume designer. I mentioned to you that I really liked that they had historical costumes with a 60s twist.
Yes, there's definitely a 60s twist because some of her hairstyles are very 60s or a 60s interpretation of what they think Egypt would have been like. This Egypt, though, was different than the Egypt that we think of, like King Tut. By this time in the Roman time, it wasn't being ruled by Egyptians. It was being ruled by Greeks. There was a lot more Greek influence in this period, and the art and the statue making of the late period wasn't as grand as that classic Egyptian style that we think of from, you know, King Tut, because a lot of that stuff had been lost, how to do it. The craftsmen weren't that good yet. So I thought it was really interesting that they were making all this like classic Egyptian sets and classic Egyptian stuff when that wasn't the actual Cleopatra. You know, they would do things in an Egyptian way, but it wasn't like the classic version that we think of.
There's a set of doors that keep showing up throughout this movie, and to me, these doors totally... They're beautiful doors. They're golden doors with a swirl design in them with these big cobra, like bronze cobra heads as handles. And to me, in my mind, that is totally like something that they were like, ooh, you know what would be so cool is if we had golden doors with cobras on it. And I just love these doors, but to me, they don't feel Egyptian or Greek or Roman. You know?
No, they felt like they belonged in a mansion in Beverly Hills.
Yes, with somebody who like went to an Egyptian museum one time and was like, gotta have that everything in my house, you know.
Yeah. I also, when you were looking at, there was a couple scenes where they go from Rome to Egypt, and I felt like you can tell the difference between Rome and Egypt. And then there's another scene where they're in Greece, in Athens, I think, on Mark Antony's honeymoon. And it was so nondescript. It was like, generic ancient city. And it was just like, okay. In the background, you can kind of see the Parthenon. And I'm like, okay, I guess that's the idea that, you know, we were supposed to be able to see it. But it's just like, come on. It was like.
Some of the chairs and furniture and stuff definitely had that 60s influence.
One of the things that also kind of made me go, huh, was that the Romans didn't use stirrups. When they didn't have stirrups part of their saddle, they controlled their horses by their legs wrapped around the body. And so it's just one of those things where it's like, those type of things threw me out of the movie. It's like, you don't have any battle scenes, but the three times you see people riding horses, they have stirrups. It's like having the tomato scene in Ben Hur, was a tomato in the background in the kitchen. It's like tomatoes came from the New World, so there was no tomatoes in ancient Rome. So it's just
because we're in Italy does not mean that there's tomatoes.
Yeah. So that is one of the things that just kind of like threw me. And so you made you wonder how much of tactics and things like that did they really go into for that last battle, other than making it look good or trying to make it look good on screen. But they also did some really interesting things. Like, they made sure that the Romans were dressed in Roman, what we would consider Roman garb. And then the Egyptians were dressed in what they considered Egyptian garb. And then every now and then the Greek influence would come out with Mark Antony and Cleopatra, because there actually was a pretty good Greek references throughout there, so that you could visually see the differences. I just don't know how accurate they are, because it looks like they just kind of pulled whatever they wanted.
Which is also very fascinating to me, since the script mentions a lot of historical accurate things. Like, when we first meet Cleopatra, though it's not truly accurate, they kept in the first meeting with Julius Caesar is her hiding in a rug.
Now, is that something that they think actually happened, or do they think that's just one of those stories people told?
They think that it's one of the stories that people told, where Mark Antony was inside the palace, lack for a better term, when her brother was ruling, and she was delivered in a rug naked. And so when he rolled out the rug, she was showed up naked. And that's like a story that a lot of people like.
Mark Antony or Julius Caesar?
Julius Caesar. So it's kind of like a fun story people like to hear. I also think it kind of feeds into that whole, like, she was a sexual manipulator and like a beautiful woman who was super smart and wasn't afraid to use her women's sexuality to get what she wants, which sometimes when people write women, especially women like that, it's really hard to get rid of that story, even though she was also extremely educated in multiple languages. She knew mathematics, and she was really good at battle planning and things like that. But a lot of people like to focus on her sexual wills.
Well, yeah, that's a way of explaining her success. Instead of saying she was intelligent and had talent, they basically are saying, no, she got there because of sex. It's still being used. Variations of that is still being used today, in, you know, to affect women in their careers.
So we've mentioned before that this is a historical drama, and as a family, we love historical dramas in all of its form. So I want to ask, what makes a great historical drama?
Well, there has to be some accuracy. But I don't get hung up on, is it super accurate or not? Apollo 13 is a good example. It's like, it's pretty accurate, but there's parts, the combined characters or people that were involved, they changed some of the timing of certain things. But overall, it's generally a very accurate film, but they never let the story get squashed and the excitement and the drama get squashed by trying to be so accurate. Sometimes I've watched movies that should have been exciting because the story they're telling is super exciting, but it's just so weighed down with either messaging that the director and writer wanted to get across. I mean, I think one of the worst films I've ever seen that's a historical drama is Gods and Generals about the Civil War. It's just pandering to the lost cause, and it just crushes any real analysis of what the Civil War, these characters, the type of people that were living at that time, just crushes it. So there's no sense of drama or interest at all. And I think it's another thing that they have to watch out for. Why are they making this film, this historical film? Sometimes they're just making it because it's an exciting story and it's fun to watch. Other times, there's a reason why they're making it, and you'll find out pretty quickly within the first 10 minutes if there's a political or message that's part of the agenda of making that film. So stay away from those.
I think what makes a good historical film is when movies connect with the material. They like try to make a meaningful story, but while also being accurate and being accurate to the period and not picking and choosing. I find a lot of the historical films that I don't particularly enjoy are the ones that pick and choose what they want to be accurate and what they don't want to be accurate. Also who they focus on too, because sometimes you can tell a cool story, but having, you know, somebody, you know, having a certain character be the audience point of view might not necessarily allow you to experience the whole story. And I think sometimes that also weighs down on historical drama, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, I think if they tell the story, finding the through point, like if you're going to tell the story through a certain character's point of view, totally buy into that character's point of view. Realize you cannot tell the full story. You just can't. It's not a documentary. If story is too big for that one character, then you got to trim it down to that character's point of view.
And since this is a biopic, technically, one of the things that I find when watching historical drama biopics is that you should know that you're not going to tell the whole story of the person's life, and which is one of the reasons why I think this movie is a little bit too long, is because they try to fit every single major plot point in Cleopatra's life. You're not going to tell the whole story, and pick an interesting topic. There's a reason why Ruth Bader Ginsburg has multiple biopics and multiple documentaries about her, because her life is super fascinating. Some of them overlap story-wise, but they're all different takes of the same thing. And I think that's also very interesting as well when you try to do that. One of the things that I find in this movie that doesn't really work well is the fact that they try to fit every single plot point from Cleopatra's life into it. And I think that's what makes it too long.
Yeah, that's what, like, so this is kind of like, for me, the classic point of what you're trying to say is that we get to see the reenactment of Caesar being killed at the Senate. And we go through that whole big scene. We've all seen it before in different versions.
But it makes no sense why it's in the film, since this film is called Cleopatra Julius Caesar.
I know, but it affects her. And the thing that kind of makes me go, what? You see her having the scene with the soothsayer who shows her that what's going to happen to Caesar, and Then you see it happen to Caesar, and then you see her reaction to what happened to Caesar. And it's like, so we kind of get the scene replayed three different times. Having them pick just one version of that scene, Cleopatra's story, you should see it, the scenes there from her point of view. And there's also another scene too later on where Mark Anthony is on his honeymoon with Octavia, and he's sending ambassadors to Cleopatra to try to get back in good with her again, why aren't we seeing her turning away the ambassadors? Why aren't we seeing her? And this is part of the movie they lost. I mean, why are we not seeing these, the, you know, it's like her point of view. It should be her being the queen on the throne, ruling, not watching all these other people in Rome do their stuff. But I think it would have been way more interesting just seeing her point of view and how she has to keep shuffling the cards that she's being dealt because of what's happening by forces she has no control over.
One thing I also had a problem with this movie when I'm watching it all 4 hours together is that she never really gets a chance to prove that she should be queen.
For me, that like, it was obviously they wanted to talk about the men in her life more than her.
Yeah, that's kind of the, like I mentioned before, that's kind of a trap that she falls into. Just as a historical character, that's kind of the trap that she, you know, because it's always, first of all, she's the 7th Cleopatra, you know, she's not the first, you know, she's the 7th Cleopatra in this line. And when we say Cleopatra, we always think about, oh, her love life with Mark Antony, and Julius Caesar. And then there's another romance that apparently got cut and is now on the cutting room floor with another Greek man in this movie, and I forget which name he is. There's a lot of references to her love life, but I was just thinking right now that I feel like this movie would be better called Julius Caesar and Mark Antony in Egypt.
No, I mean, that's the thing. There's some really she has some really powerful scenes, and she has some really powerful stuff going on, and she is the one through thread all the way through the film, just because she's the one character that's at the beginning and at the end, and she's all the way through. I just think that they kind of squashed her a little bit, and they didn't let her come to life. And Elizabeth Taylor is great to look at on screen, and I don't understand why they were afraid to not just have her be Cleopatra.
So for our final thoughts, so this movie is considered a classic. Do you think that it deserves this title?
No.
Okay. Thank you guys for watching the Movie Log.
Watching? No. I don't think it deserves the title of a classic because it never quite gets there. Okay. I don't think it's unwatchable. I don't think that it's a bad, bad film. I give it like, you know, a C-minus average on it or something like that. There's a lot of stuff they could have done to make it work.
I think Cleopatra gets swept under the things that happened behind the camera.
There's a lot that's put on this film that doesn't deserve. But I still don't think it's a classic.
So we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. We will be posting a new show every Tuesday. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to our podcast and write a review. Follow us on Instagram at TML, A Journey Through Cinema. We also have a Facebook page under the Movie Log. If you would like to engage with us, you know, suggest a movie for us to watch for season 2. Tell us how amazing we are. Instagram and Facebook are the 2 social media websites that we interact with most. Next week we will be...
Ooh, yeah. Next week is going to be one of my favorite films I got to watch when I used to go to film festivals. It wasn't out yet. And I started following the director of that film. I really like his work. You'll know his work recently, and it also introduced me to a couple actors that I really, really enjoyed. All right, so that's next week. We'll be discussing
our penultimate episode of season 1.
Yes. All right, everybody have a great day, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.